Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Your Personal Finance with Dr. Charles Ross. Hope your day or evening or whenever you're listening to this is going very, very well. As you know, one of my favorite topics to talk about is real estate because, as I've told you before, there are a couple of ways that millionaires, billionaires make money. One of them is owning a business, and the other one is real estate, and generally, they have both in their portfolio. So that's why I like to talk about that and different ways that you can invest in real estate. My guest today is Angelo Webb. He hails from Houston, Texas, and he invests in commercial and apartments. He's a former regional manager of 2,000 plus units. He's a multifamily consultant and coach and a value add specialist. Currently, he owns 48 doors with an additional 24 under contract, and we'll talk with what he means by 48 doors. So welcome, Angelo Webb, to Your Personal Finance. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing well. How about you? Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure to talk to you. I always like to have young brothers and sisters on that are changing the narrative. As a real estate investor myself, I have a natural affinity for those that are doing things in that area or owning a business. And so we appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us. So before we get started, share a little bit about your background, you know, where you're from, where you went to school, you know, where you worked at before you got into to real estate.
Right. Well, I'm originally from St. Louis, Missouri, born and raised there. I recently moved down to Houston last year. So I've only been down in Houston for about a year. But I did attend college. I went to Emporia State University, which is in Kansas. Did I get my degree in real estate? Absolutely not. I got it in sports management. But right out of college, the first thing I did was get into the apartment industry because I knew that it was something that I wanted to do. My parents were real estate investors. They focus more on single family homes than duplexes. And I just always thought as a kid, the next progression for me, right, for the next generation would be to move to apartments or hotels. So I kind of made it a point right out of college. I made it a point to get into the industry and use it as a learning experience for my future investment.
Awesome, awesome. So when you say you got into the industry, you mean you worked for an apartment complex or a property manager? Enlighten a little bit on that with that experience.
I started out as a leasing agent. I mean, that's pretty much if you're going into the multifamily side of things, a leasing agent is where you start at. So I started out as a leasing agent. I did have the opportunity to come in straight as an assistant manager because I did have the college education. However, I chose to start out as a leasing manager, leasing agent, because I wanted to understand the process. I didn't necessarily want to be an expert on every part of it, but I wanted to make sure that I had a general understanding of each part of the process.
Okay, that makes sense. So I'm assuming you worked for an apartment complex, apartment complex or an owner of apartment complexes. Would that be correct?
Yes. Correct.
Okay.
It was the name of the company is Nolan Real Estate. They're really big here in Texas. They have a few properties in the Midwest, mostly in the Kansas City area. At that time, they had only two properties in St. Louis. So they are what I would consider a medium-sized owner-operator.
Okay. And so you started out as a leasing agent, leasing apartments to families and individuals. How long did you do that? How long did you do that for?
I was in that role for about 9 months. So in multifamily, there's a type of funding called LIHTC, which I'm not sure if you've talked about before, but it's a low-income housing tax credit. And it's a way for owners and investors to either buy new property or rehab a property that they already have. And that comes with a lot of stipulations, similar to a lot of the regulations with Section 8. One of the assistant managers there took me under her wing and taught me how to do a file and taught me all the rules of this. And I'm so thankful that she did, because that allowed me to move up so much quicker in the industry, because nobody wants to do government housing. Anything that has to do with anything government housing, people usually run away from because of the paperwork, right?
Right.
So me having that and wanting to do it because I just wanted to keep getting higher so I could learn more. I was only in that position for 9 months before I actually became an assistant manager.
Okay, so you became let's go back. Where did you say that regulation was? You said YTEX? You said something about
LIHTC.
How do you spell that?
Yeah, it's LIHTC. And that's just the acronym for low-income housing tax credit.
Okay. All right. I'm taking notes at the same time I'm listening.
Okay. No, it's okay.
So low-income tax credit, because that's interesting. So just for a minute, let's go back to that for a second. So why was that important, the LIHTC was so important? I mean, what is it? Now, I'm familiar with Section 8 because I have Section 8 housing. So I understand that part. So how is that similar to Section 8? I mean, does that allow you to build or buy properties that you focus on low income? What's the deal with that?
Yeah, correct. That's pretty accurate. So what it does is really that allows you to get a loan that's backed by the government that is essentially a tax write-off for a bank. But what comes with that stipulation is pretty much it's spot on. It actually was designed from Section 8. So the income limit, everything you deal with the Section 8 property is the same thing you would deal with a property that has LIHTC funds that was used LIHTC funds to be built or rehabbed. So it's very popular now. It started in the 80s, I think it was late 80s, and it's grown tremendously. When a lot of times whenever you see like a newer apartment, it might be in like a C neighborhood or a B-minus neighborhood, especially if you see one in a C neighborhood or a D neighborhood and it looks like it belongs in the A side of the or A part of the city, most likely it was used with LIHTC fund. It's very, very common now. A lot of people are using it.
Now you know we're going to have to go back and define these different classifications for areas. So, you know, because our listeners, obviously. But it's good. No, this is educational, because a lot of people probably say, whoa, I didn't know that. So the LIHTC housing allows you. So, for example, if you're in a certain – I'm just kind of giving an example of where this might apply. So if you're in a neighborhood that's a C or D neighborhood, then if you buy a property – the stipulation is that you have to have folks that are low income that are going to have apartment or have be tenants in those apartments. Is that the way it works?
Yeah, that's a very simplified version of how it works.
Okay.
Because what you have to do is you have to put like a whole proposal together. So it's only a certain amount of these funds that go out each year per state. And you have to put, whenever they open up the enrollment, you have to have a whole package together of the property that you want. You have to do a whole feasibility study on what the area income is, the median income is for the area. show that there's a lack of affordable housing or quality affordable housing. So there's a whole process to it. But to simplify it, that's correct. You know, you have to. It's a thing called that we call the LORA, which is the Land Usage Restriction Agreement, and the LORA will state how many of the apartments have to be low income, and what percentage, how many of them can be market, because you can have some market ones. So it actually gets a little different for each property depending on the LORA.
Okay, so if you were buying, say for example, there was an apartment complex to sell. Mm-hmm. So I'm assuming you're not building. I guess you could build apartments in that regard. Would they let you build, or just have to be rehab, or you're buying an apartment mm-hmm. complex and going to convert it so that low income?
You can build. That's where it's most commonly used, in new construction.
Oh, okay.
You can build with it. And then you also can, if you have a property already, you can rehab using those funds. But again, there's a whole selection process that you have to go through before you're awarded those funds.
Okay. And those funds, I'm assuming, are in the form of a loan, I guess a low-interest loan or something like that?
Correct. It's a super low-interest loan. And then on this part, even for myself, because I have never been at that top level where they negotiate with banks and HUD, but my understanding of it is it's pretty much a loan that is forgiven. It's a tax write-off, essentially. So let's say it costs $10 million to build the property, right? They say it's going to cost $10 million to build the property. The LIHTC loan, the funds from the LIHTC might be $8 million. So then you really only have to go out and get $2 million. You know, from another lender or from a third-party lender.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then what happens is you have to be in compliance for the next, depending on the LORA, you have to be in compliance for the next 15 to 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Whatever.
And so what that means is, yeah. So
you're saying based on your proposal, then you have to be in compliance. Like if you said 50% would be low income, you have to stay in compliance with that during the duration of that period.
Correct.
Okay, gotcha.
That's 100% correct. And what happens is, and the reason some people run away from it or some companies don't deal with it, is if you do not stay in compliance for a certain amount of time, all those tax credits that you were awarded that $8 million, has to be paid back.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it's all right. It's very strict, you know. Anything with government funds is very strict, and it's a lot of paperwork. But so it's usually a 15 to 20 year period that you have to keep that together. And if you come out of compliance for so long, and that's bankrupting companies and people. Like, yeah, I've seen it happen.
Okay.
Typically, when that happens, the company that I used to work for, we would come in and buy the property because we had a good. You know, we had a good history with the LIHTC properties, and we knew how to run them. Yeah, it happened.
So these would be multifamily apartment complexes. This wouldn't be single-family homes then that we're talking about.
Correct.
Apartment complexes. Okay. All right. Gotcha.
Yes, sir. Apartment complexes.
Well, good. Okay, and so let's go back and so we can clear up what are A, B, C, D neighborhoods. So give us a little overview of and you're talking now about commercial and apartment complexes, areas that are designated in that fashion, A, B, C, or D. So explain what that means for the layperson.
Mm-hmm. And this can apply to single family as well.
Mm-hmm.
But a neighborhood is typically where you see two income households, usually two highly educated people who both are making close to six figures or six figures, great schools, great hospitals, top of the line shopping and malls. That's what you see in the neighborhood. Little to no crime. Any crime that you see in neighborhoods like that is typically around the retail areas where crime happens, right? Those are opportunities, crime opportunities. A neighborhood is usually what we think about. Like, if you watch Fresh Prince of Bel Air, they lived in an A neighborhood.
Okay.
That's an A neighborhood. So, and then like a B neighborhood, we would consider something where there's usually business owners or some person in the family that has their own business that's based off of a trade, right? You know, plumber, electrician, or maybe they own the local Ben and Jerry's franchise or something like that. You know, so the B neighborhoods is where you usually see small business owners, or you see people who are in upper management for corporate America. You know, your regional managers, your vice presidents. That's what we consider a B neighborhood. And then once you see like a C neighborhood, we will consider that working class neighborhood. I have a lot of people that work in manufacturing, a lot of people that work as servers, some part of the service industry. That's what we would see more in the C neighborhood. And the C neighborhood is where you start seeing the schools are kind of okay, and it might depend on what part of the neighborhood you live in and what part, you know, depending on the school the kid goes to. The crime can be a little bit higher, maybe not crime-ridden per se, but, you know, crime is more prevalent there than you will see in the A and the B neighborhoods. And then once we get to D neighborhoods, that's when you're talking about neighborhoods where you will see a lot of abandoned single-family homes, where the crime is more prevalent, school systems not doing well. That's what we consider a D neighborhood.
Gotcha. So how are these neighborhoods designated? Is that by census information, pretty much?
Actually, it's really just based off of knowing the area. You know, because you can't really go, you can kind of use government statistics, but they would themselves would never designate anything like that. You know, that's kind of a lingo that's just used in the industry. And sometimes, you know, you have to do some research, but anybody that that's listening, you know, wherever you live and you know the area, when I explained what A, B, C, and D was, you know, you probably in your mind was like, okay, well, that area is A, this area is B, that area is C, that area is D. So it's kind of, you have to know the market that you're in and realize what area you're in. But, you know, when people are from a certain place, they know what areas are what.
Right. They kind of know what everybody, I think, knows what a D neighborhood is. And now you said an A neighborhood, Prince of Belly, we know what that is. I think it's the B and the C ones that might be a little like, okay, am I in a B or C? You know if you're in a D neighborhood. And I know when you said that, certain neighborhoods in Atlanta, I live in the Atlanta area, came to mind. I said, oh, okay, I know exactly what a D neighborhood is. But then I would think, Angelo, that may be opportunity, because what I see happening in Atlanta, and I don't know about Houston and other areas of the country, that some of the D neighborhoods are being gentrified, where they're going in because the property values have been depreciated. No one's wanting to live there. There's no goods or services, no shopping really, no grocery stores. There might be a bodega, as I call it, you know, a little, you know, bodega, a little grocery store owned by, you know, an ethnic group or something of that nature, or even a black person for that matter. So you don't see all that. So I know exactly, you know, what, because I think the school where I'm an educator at, I think that's a D neighborhood. But it is going through gentrification, where there are streets around the school where I have seen, single family homes go from, they buy them for 30, 40 grand, and then they sell them for 250. Okay. So, you know, all that's happening around the school. So, you know, gentrification is really ongoing. All right, good. That was great information, man. I appreciate that. So how long have you been a real estate investor? Did you leave the leasing agent job, the assistant manager job, or you still do that, or what's going on?
Well, now what I do is I work for a real estate educational company, and that's where my consulting and coaching comes in at. And what we do is, you know, we teach people certain aspects of it. I'm in charge of multifamily operations and multifamily acquisitions of it. So I teach our members, like, you know, once you find a deal, how you look at it, how to analyze it, and the word value add specialist, that's where that comes in at. And, you know, I've done a very good job of finding those opportunities once they find the deal. And then we talk about, hey, what's a good price point? to buy it at, so it is a good investment. And we talk about exit strategies as well. And then once they actually do purchase those assets, what we do is we help them with the operations side of it. So if they're having some issues, we'll say, okay, well, this is what's going on operationally, and this is the problem. You know, you can do A, B, and C, and that'll rectify that problem. And this is how that affects the bottom line, how it ultimately affects the value of the property.
So you've been, so are you self-employed now? Or are you still, you know, working for the leasing company? It doesn't sound like you're working for the lease for the apartment company.
No, I don't. Yeah, I don't work for the. I don't work for a property management company. Or no, sir.
Okay. All right. So you're an entrepreneur. You're on your own then, pretty much.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And so, and how long have you been doing that? How long have you, you know, left the leasing and now you're doing your own thing?
I've been out of leasing. I've been out of property management as far as a property management company full time for about a year now.
For 1 year. Okay. And so I see where you shared that you currently own 48 doors. Okay. And explain what that means. 48 doors.
Well, 48, yeah, doors, again, that's a lingo. That just means apartment units.
Okay.
So my heart, so, the portfolio itself consists of 48 apartment units.
48 apartment units, okay. Are those in one apartment complex, or are they spread among a couple of different ones?
It's three separate ones.
Okay, so three separate apartment. And I'm assuming that you bought these apartment complexes. So that's what.
Correct.
You know. Okay, and so you have an additional 24 under contract, meaning you put out an offer, and they accepted your offer, and now it's under contract, and you're working out the financing. Is that correct?
Yes, right now. Well, even we're not even at the quite the. So once you write a contract for multifamily or commercial, you kind of have these set dates and times. So we're right now for that particular property. It's all in one property, so it's 24 doors in one property. That particular property, we're under what we call the due diligence phase. So right now is where we're auditing. You know, so I'm looking at the bills that they paid. I'm looking at the leases that they have. I'm looking at the rent rolls. I'm making sure that everything that they told me is accurate. Your asking price is based off of what we call the NOI, the net operating income. But we have to make sure that what they told us and what the information they've given us is accurate. Is it ever 100% accurate? I can think out of the 50 to 60 transactions that I've been a part of, the numbers are accurate once. So you always go through and we have to verify. And sometimes it's intentional, sometimes it's really not. You know, or they might look at another parameter. You know, they might say, well, over the last 3 months, this is the number, but I'm going to look at the last 12 months. I want to see the average. Because 3 months can be seasonal, right? Because those 3 months might be the month that things pick up. I want to see the average for the last 12 months. So, and sometimes, like I said, sometimes it's intentional because they're fishing for fools. And other times it's really not necessarily intentional. They just analyze a different way. So we're in a due diligence phase for that one right now.
Got you. So you said, if I heard you correctly, you said out of the 50 deals that you've been a part of, the financials were only accurate only one time, one out of 50. Okay.
Yeah, and I would say they're accurate based off of the, you know, they put out the marketing, right? And I said, this, you know, we're selling this for this. You know, this is what it brings in. These are the expenses. And once you look at the numbers and you break it down, one of them aren't accurate. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Like, even if it's now, if it's off by a few, depending on the size of the property, if it's off by a few thousand, okay. But if it's a small property and it's off by 5,000 or 6,000, that makes a really big deal. So we have to, you know, that's when we go in, and that's when we really find those opportunities to add value. In an apartment, the way you add value is just by increasing the net operating income. So we might look at their expenses and we're like, okay, why in the world are they paying this much for pest control or this much for trash, right? And we know that our contractors or the company that we work do it for half the price. We just lowered the expenses, which increased the net operating income, and we just increased the value of the property. So that's why the due diligence phase is so important, because this is where you can really find on paper your opportunities to increase the value of that property.
Gotcha. Now, I know in single-family homes, the we work. I'm in a market in a sub 35 market, right? And and one of the things that we operate on, I mean, you know, I'm not so much concerned about the price of the home. I mean, I am concerned about it to some extent because it has to appraise right to get a loan and all that. But I'm looking at the cap rate. So, for example, I'm looking at properties, doing the numbers, cap rates anywhere from 15 to 20%. You know, more closer to 20%. Mm-hmm. When you're looking at on commercial and apartment complexes, do you look at similar kinds of numbers?
The cap rate is very important. The NOI, and the reason the NOI is so important, and I've said that a couple times, is we need to know the NOI so we know our cap rate. For us, the cap rate is like the gospel. Like the cap rate is everything, right? So, but in apartments, it does work a little bit different. Where you know, if we see cap rates that high, either there's something wrong. Like, if I see a 20% cap rate on an apartment, it's either in a very, 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 very bad area, or somebody is so sick and tired of a half decent property that they just need to get rid of it. Maybe an emergency came up and they need $200,000. So they can just sell it for a lot lower than what it's worth just to get rid of it quickly. Because the process for buying an apartment is a lot longer than the process for buying a single family home.
And we'll get to that for a second. So what's a typical cap rate that you look at? What's the minimum cap rate that you look at to buy a commercial property? It's particularly apartment complex.
Well, specifically me, anything over 12, I'll start kind of giving the side eye. But if it's over 12 and there's a explanation to why it's over 12, I'll take a look at it. Because what's very important is we have to always remember the banks, right? And there's, after the cap rate goes over a certain percentage, it usually hit like 13 or more, banks are a little iffy. And the choices that you have to go to certain banks, iffy. So the banks look at it like this: the higher the cap rate, the more of a risk. That's how a bank is going to evaluate that.
The higher
it is, the more the risk, right? So that's how they look at that. They say, well, man, this is a 15% cap rate. It's a, you know, and they're going to say, okay, well, that's kind of risky for us. But if we can explain to them it's 15 now because of X, Y, and Z, this is what our plan is for the next 24 to 36 months to turn this property around to make it more secure and make it a more secure loan. If we, you know, you plan that all out to a bank, they'll say, you know what, that makes sense for that area, that is definitely possible. Okay, let's do it. And then a few years down the road, 3 or 4 years down the road, when you go to refinance, they might look at it and give it a cap rate at 7% now because it, or 8% now, just because it's much secure a loan for them because we've improved the operations and the properties.
So what's the minimum cap rate? So you said on the high end you won't look at anything over 12%. What's on the low end in terms of what you look at?
On the low end, again, and that 12%, again, if there's a reason why it's 15%, because it's a fire sale, because somebody has to, you know, or somebody's going bankrupt and they need to sell, I'm all for it. But just a typical, I would say 12. But on the low end, again, on the low end, man, any 5 or 6.
But wow.
Even at the 5 or 6, there has to be, and this is for me, and I'm saying all this for me as an individual and for people who kind of work similar to me, who have a similar goal, 5 to 6% is usually the lowest that we can go, but we would have to be able to see that there's an opportunity to add value to that property.
A lot of times, if you
start seeing 5 or 6 or lower, that is more of an institutional buy. That's more for your insurance companies, for your Berkshire Hathaways, these huge funds, right, that have to get some kind of return. Even if it's not a great one, just a small one, you know, those are their kind of buys where it's yield plays. And hopefully, God willing, one day I'll be in that position where I got so much money that I've got to make yield plays, but I'm not there yet.
Right there, yeah. So your parents were involved in the beginning, and they were doing single-family homes. Were they full-time real estate investors, or they were doing this as a side hustle on the side?
They were doing it as a side hustle. That's really, honestly, that's why I get most of who I am is from my parents and my family. My parents were hustlers. My mom is, in my eyes, is probably the ultimate hustler. My mother had a high school education, and when she went to go to college, they did not let her in. You know, they told my mother that her high school diploma wasn't as valuable as some kids from the other part of town. So my mom didn't think she was able to go to college, and she ended up being able to go to college, and she only went for one semester. But when my mother retired, she was the VP of operations for a Fortune 500 company. She worked her tail off. Very smart lady. She worked her tail off. And she rose up in corporate America.
So with the side hustle, how many properties did they own at the height of what they were doing? How many?
At the height of it, I think they owned, if you include the duplexes and separate doors, I think all together maybe like 30, 35 doors.
Wow. And they were doing all that as a side hustle? Wow.
As a side hustle. And my dad's a blue collar dude, man. He worked third shift as a welder. So my dad's blue collar as a kid.
Wow. So that was a little side hustle, and I would imagine, do they still own those properties? Or some of them?
No, they don't. Actually, no, my mother, again, being such a smart lady, and again, me learning, where I learned this from is, you know, working in corporate America is about education. It's not necessarily about just a check. You want to learn everything you can from corporate America and apply it to your life. Working in her position in her industry, she saw where the market was going in 2004 and in 2005. She saw that coming, and they sold pretty much all of them at that point, or most of them at that point, except a couple of cash cows. And I mean, they were not negatively affected when the market got destroyed in 2004, 2005.
Wow. So right now they're not back in the game. They're out of the game at this point, then, I guess.
Oh yeah, they're out of the game, but they're okay though. They they're not hurting. I'll tell you that.
Okay. All right. Good. And that's the key. You know, markets come and go, ups and downs, and that's why, you know, I mean, everybody, you know, picks their own little niche. You know, my niche for my wife and I is buy and hold in these sub 30 markets in a market where, you know, folks can only afford maybe rents of $600 to $700, $800 a month. And there are markets all around the country for that. You just have to find them. And you may not get much appreciation, but what you're looking for is that cash flow, that cap rate. You know, you're looking for that to be you know, on a regular basis. So you chose commercial because you were a leasing agent. Now, when you say commercial, outside of apartments, do you own any other kind of commercial? You know, warehouses, you know, storage units or anything like that?
No, just apartments. But, you know, anything, and I say commercial because for us in the industry, anything over five units, anything over five, like residential dwellings, we consider commercial. So we just break it down as commercial because it's all evaluated the same.
Yeah, okay, great. Yeah, because, you know, our strategy has been you know, I'm 62. I'm going to retire in about 3 or 4 years. My goal is to acquire about 20 to 25 properties in the 30 to 35,000 range, renting them out for $600-$700 a month. That would generate about $150,000 in gross income. And you know, I figure if I can't retire on that, something's wrong. You know,
if you can't retire on that, man, you can't retire.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I tell people. And this leads me into a question for you, is that, you know, what's your end game? What's your retirement strategy? Because when you talk to people, they don't really think about it because, see, I'm kind of long in the tooth. I remember in the 70s and 80s when they did away with pension plans. Fortunately, I'm in education. Mm-hmm. We do have a pension. But they did away with pension plans. And the only people that have pension plans these days are educators and anybody working for the city, county, or state, or federal government.
Right.
And so if you got a 401k or 403b, they say, oh, I've got a 401k. I said, is it over $1 million? I said, because, you know, you have to draw down on that puppy to, you know, once you retire. And what you find is that you have so many, especially baby boomers, which I'm part of, who are working into their 70s, not because they want to, but because they have to. And that's a whole different approach, as you know, because, you know, you're self-employed.
Right.
So it's a different thing when you get up in the morning, you can do whatever you want, you know, based on, you know, what you have on your plate. You don't have a clock. You don't have a boss, you know, to report to. You could go out and look for deals, you know, and get them funded and all that kind of stuff. And so it's a whole different, you know, and I had my own business, you know, 20 years ago, and that's a great thing. You know, now, obviously, you got to have that income coming in. So I ask, you know, and this is leading me to the question I ask you, is what's your end game? You know, I don't know how old you are, but you look relatively young.
I'm 34.
Oh, well, you're very, very young. Yeah. My daughter's my oldest daughter's 38. You know, so you've got a great, you know, year, future ahead of you. So what's your end game? I mean, when you're going to finally say, okay, I've done what I want to do, I'm good, I'm just going to maintain what I have, or is that, or will you ever get to that point? So what's your end game? What's your strategy to say I'm done?
To be honest with you, as far as this goes, as far as multifamily goes, I don't have an end. When God calls me home, I don't have an end game for it, because I want to build it. Because, like you said in the beginning, when we first got on, millionaires and billionaires, this is where their money comes from. 90% of millionaires and billionaires made it in real estate. So I know for my kids and my kids' kids and so on, that is going to be the easiest path to the wealth. And so I want to build as big as I can. You know, I don't want to go so big that I can't control it, or I don't have some, you know, systems in place. But I want to keep growing and keep growing and keep growing, because I want my kids to have something. I want my grandkids to have something. I would say the ultimate end game for me, or what I would consider success in this, is I have my kids, and I've taught my kids this, and I've been able to bring my kids aboard, so they can do what they want to do in life, and they can go after their passions and not chase a check.
Gotcha.
For me, that would be success.
So you're looking.
That would be my success.
So you're looking at establishing a legacy. In other words, you know, like the billionaires and millionaires do, you know, they build their business, and then eventually they turn it over to their children, you know, and their grandchildren perhaps to run it, you know. Or what they normally do sometimes is that sometimes your children don't want to come into the business for whatever reason, but then they hire a manager, you know, to manage it and that kind of thing, which is an option.
Right.
You know, because I could see, you know, what you're doing, apartment complexes, you could get to the point where you have a manager managing all this stuff and you're just out there looking for deals. And so you're not really counting on you're getting the income from the properties to, you know, to live on and to take care of your family. But at some point you say, okay, I'm, you know, and this may be when you're 70 or 80, but, you know, you got millionaires still hitting the lick, you know, Warren Buffett's still doing it. I don't know how old he is. He's like, what, 80 or something?
Right.
You know,
hey,
I'm
man,
sure
he's still doing it big.
Yeah, I'm sure he's not working as hard. I mean, and now he has folks who probably find deals for him and bring them to him, and then he analyzes. But he's not out there hitting the lick like he did when he was starting out. So it's a whole different way of maintaining, you know, what you're doing. Now, you call yourself a value-add specialist. Explain what that means.
So a value-add specialist is when you find the missing value, or you find how to add value to a property, similarly like you would do if you're flipping a home, right? If you're flipping a single-family home, you'll pull up to the house, and you'll say, okay, landscaping needs to be done to improve the value of the house. Walk in, and you say, okay, the kitchen definitely needs to be redone. That's how we're going to add value to the house. You go to the bathrooms, and one bathroom, you might be like, oh, man, they did this bathroom already, okay? We don't have to do that. You go to the other ones, they might need improvement. The same is similar for us when we look at multifamily. But it's usually the operation side of things more than anything. Sometimes it is deferred maintenance, and you do have to make some rehabs or repairs. In serious cases, do some remodeling. But for us, the value is built by increasing the NOI. If we increase the NOI, and there's two ways of doing that. There's two ways to increase the NOI. You either bring in more money, or you cut expenses, right? And I'm sure that sounds familiar to everybody, because that's the same thing we do with our own budget, right? Like, man, I need to make some more money, or like, man, I need to stop spending money on worthless things or useless things. That's the same way we look at it when we are looking at an apartment or we own an apartment. And if we can find those things where they're paying too much on the expenses, or the rents are not at market and they're super low, or they're giving away a lot of concessions for no reason, that's where we find that value in it. Or maybe there's no washers and dryers on site. If there's an empty storage area that's not being used, you can partner with a local laundromat or laundry service to get a laundromat in there. You get like 40% of the profits, they get 60%, but you're not maintaining anything. You're not maintaining the machines or nothing like that. But you just brought more income into the property. So you just increase the value of the property. Some people don't look at it like that, you know, and that's where I really find, kind of found my niche in this, is looking and seeing those opportunities that a lot of people don't see or don't understand that they're there.
Gotcha. And that sounds like what happened in the 80s and maybe 90s, but definitely the 70s and 80s with, folks that were raiding companies. You know, they'd go in and look at a corporation and say, okay, let's say they want $10 million for it. And then they would say, okay, well, let me look at the pension plan. Can we get rid of that? You know, if a pension is overfunded, they could get rid of it. You know, they could make sure they have enough money to satisfy the current, you know, the current participants in the plan. Or they look at the real estate that's there. So, for example, you know, I know this happened with a lot of retail companies where the real estate was valued at cost and never was appraised to say, okay, they bought it 20 years ago. It's not worth $1 million now. It's worth $20 million. So they'd go in and find ways they could, you know, buy a company and make some of their money back from what they bought based on cutting expenses or selling off assets and, you know, things like that. So that's what it kind of, you know, sounds like when I think about that. And that's a whole other conversation for another day, but what happened
But that's exactly what it is, because when you're in commercial real estate, your property is evaluated the same way they would evaluate Google, the same way they would evaluate JCPenney or Shell Oil Company. It's a business, right? Mm-hmm. That's a business, and it actually gets evaluated the exact same way as any other business.
Wow.
So the point that you made is extremely relevant to it, because that's how we found out our value. The same way is the same way a company would.
So you say you're a value added specialist because you go in and look at a property and say, okay, based on my experience in leasing and commercial real estate and apartment managing, you know, I can find ways to get more money out of that property. Whereas raising the rents, or like you said, getting a laundromat, or whatever the case may be, or cutting expenses, you know, saving money with pest control or what have you, and things like that, you know, can create value. And definitely, once you bought the property, you can make those changes, and then obviously, you know, reap the benefits of increased appraisal, and obviously an additional income from that standpoint. But that's interesting, you know, that you mentioned that. What was the biggest obstacle, Angelo, for you to overcome getting in? I mean, when you made the transition from a leasing agent, assistant manager for an apartment complex, to being on your own, I mean, was it I'm done, I'm out the door, I'm buying property, or was it, okay, let me buy some properties while I'm still working here and then make a transition as soon as I get the income to a point where, you know, I can survive on the income coming from the property? Mm-hmm. So explain to us, you know, how your transition went.
Well, it was a slow transition. I started how many people started. I started wholesaling. I was like wholesaling here and there. Not very active, but kind of here and there. And as I kept moving up, because, you know, eventually I became a regional manager. So I kept moving up in corporate America. And what happened was, I was working for a very large company back home. and they're a privately owned company, owned by a family. And they would get deals that were small, right? They would get deals that were 12 units to 48 units. And literally, if those come, they went right out the door. It wasn't enough zeros involved. They're that kind of company, right? So what I did to kind of fine-tune my analyzing skills or my analyzing skills is I would look at those and take the same thing that I had learned at that company, looking at deals with 300, 400 apartments that were worth $20, $30, $40, $50 million. I took that and I would do it to these small ones. And I used those to hone my skills, say, okay, so this is worth it. This is the opportunity there. This is that. So actually the first deal that I got was one of those ones that was supposed to go in the trash can. I said to myself, this is actually like a great deal. You know, so I went to the president of our division and I told him, I said, hey, I know that we're really not supposed to be looking at these, but I did kind of run the numbers. But I told him it was a gut instinct, and I showed it to him. He said, "Well, man, listen, the cash on cash is ridiculous, you know." And what we do, what we call that at that level is what we call sophisticated investing, is what I still do. So I showed him like, "Hey, at year two or year three, if we refi, we'll get all the money back plus pretty much double." You know, he's sitting there scratching his head like, well, we can't justify not doing this deal because of the returns. He said, but there's no way our banks are going to deal with less than $1 million. They deal with the big boys. Like when I say big boys, they only deal with the big boys and the big banks. He said, let me hold on to this and come back to me tomorrow. So I went back to him the next day and he said, well, listen, I do know a smaller bank here. And he talked to me about what we call syndicating. And he said, do you know about syndicating? I said, I know the word. I don't know how to do it. He said, well, that's how we buy our property. You know, we do syndication. He told me, hey, me and you get in on this deal. I'll syndicate this deal with people I know personally that might be interested in something like this. You get a piece of the deal, and I'll walk you through the process so you understand how it works. That was my first deal. I mean, it was supposed to be in the trash. And,
wow.
Like I said, I wanted to learn so much, and I wanted to apply, because when I looked at everything, I just knew whatever I was doing at work with the assets that we were buying, I was going to have to take off a couple zeros for me, but the process was still the same at the end of the day.
So if I hear you correctly, so you went to your boss and say, hey, I got this deal. I've looked at it, ran the numbers, and, you know, it's a great deal. It's below the target that, you know, we would buy it from, but it's a great deal. And so he went to, I guess, his, you know, little network, and they took an interest in the property. You know, what percentage of the deal did you get?
I got 15%.
15%. You still own that property?
15%. No, we sold it, but we made a killing.
Okay. So you got So you have 15%. You had to put up 15% of the money. Is that would that be accurate?
I didn't put up anything.
Oh, so wow!
With so this is a great thing about syndicating, and this is more, again, this is a very high level of apartment investing, but it could be done at any level. The thing about syndicating is you have a general partner, and that's the person with the knowledge, the person that found the deal, that knows how to do everything, and then you have the limited partners. Limited partners are people who know that they can get a good return in real estate, but they don't know what the heck they're doing, or they tried it before and they didn't know what they were doing and lost their shirt, right? And they're like, well, listen, I don't know what I'm doing. And they're looking for those opportunities, and this is as passive gets in real estate, is being the limited partner in the syndication, because they'll bring the money. You know, and obviously you can't just go to them and tell them the numbers. You have to show them a plan, right? Typically, we have a packet that's 6 or 7 pages that shows the property, shows the improvements we're going to make, and how that improvement affects the bottom line, timetable. Do a whole little package, right? So people know what they're getting into if they want to get into it. The benefit of that was I was dealing with a person who him and his brothers and dad combined are worth $1 billion. So the people that they associate with, they may not have as much money as them, you know, they still kind of think on that level on, okay, well, what's my return? How is it secured? How am I? Basically, they want to know how they're going to get their money back. If nothing else, investors want to know, how am I going to get my money back and how is my initial investment secured? If they gave you $300 and you gave them $300 back, they might be mad, but not as mad as if you gave them $300. They gave you $300 and you gave them $150 back. So they want to know how, at minimum, their investment is secure. So that's what that packet is for. But you know, those are the type of individuals we were dealing with for that deal, and that opened up me to a whole new world.
So you're saying that those people put up the money to buy the property, basically.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't go to a bank. So you went to them and said, go ahead, explain it.
Okay, yeah, we did still go to a bank, right?
Okay.
But what happens is you have to go to a smaller bank, usually a regional or a local bank that will fund something under $1 million. Because the big boys, they're only doing like $5 million or $2 million minimum plus, right? So we had to go to a different bank, and what happens is you still have those same requirements, 80%, they're going to give you 75% or 80%, but you still got to come down with the 20 or 25% down payment. The limited partners put up the money for the down payment.
Okay,
so there is still debt there. Yeah, so there is still debt there. But, again, you're buying an asset that's going to be making money. I've never bought if I look at a deal and it didn't cash flow after we got the debt for it, we don't do it. Like, that's the whole point of it. The whole point of it is the cash flow.
Right.
So when you come in, when you bring them in, they're paying the down payment. If there's any loan fees, they're paying that. And then also as a syndicator, we have what we call a syndication fee. So it's similar to how a hedge fund works. You know how a hedge fund does like the asset management fees and they own 20% of the hedge and they have like another fee? It's very similar.
Right.
You'll have a 2-3% syndication fee, and then usually a 1-2% asset management fee. So you still make money doing it, even if you don't put any money in. They pay you to come in. They pretty much pay you to come into your deal because you found it, and plus you get a part of the partnership.
So your 15% was 15% of the total deal. $1 million. Your part was $150,000. Is that correct? Roughly?
Correct. If it was $1 million.
Okay.
It was under $1 million, but yeah.
It was under $1 million. Okay.
That's how it would work. Yeah.
Okay. But you didn't have to put up any money. The syndicating partners put up the money for the down payment.
Correct.
Okay. So how do they justify your involvement? So what is it that you do or doing that warrants getting 15%?
Everything. So as a general partner, you have the knowledge, right?
Bingo.
This is your specialty.
Hey,
this is what you do.
Say no more. I get it. So your 15% is based on the knowledge that these partners don't have. They're counting on you to run the deal to help them make money. So you're getting 15% of the deal because that's your input is the knowledge and ability to manage the deal. Okay, I get it. Okay, that's cool. All right. So you got these limits. So how many partners did y'all get for this deal? How much did you have to put down, assuming it was $1 million?
Yeah, so if you assumed it was $1 million, we would have had to put down $200,000 on that one.
So that's
that
good. 20%.
And again, this is a beauty. This is a beauty because, again, this is a very powerful dude I used to work for. He's going to get the best deals possible from any bank or anybody else. So some of these numbers are best case scenario, but you're going to be looking at 20 to 25%.
Okay.
You know, really,
so the partner,
typically
so
25.
So the syndication partners put up the 20% down payment. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And so for
correct.
That, whatever, and help me with this. So let's look at 200,000. Okay. So
we're
putting up 200,000. Does their percentage of the deal based on the percentage of the down payment they put down?
No. That's a great question because that's what I assumed. But no, that's a great question. Typically, it just depends on the syndicator and it depends on the partnership and how they decide to do it. But they had they had 60%. My boss at the time had 15, and I had 15. I'm sorry, they had 70. No, I'm sorry.
So they had
70? 60, 25, 15.
Okay. A 60, 25, 50. Okay. So, okay, I got you. So the partners, the syndication partners had 60% in total, and then you and your boss split kind of the rest of it, the other 40% or so.
Correct.
He had 25%, you had 15%.
Correct.
Okay. So now, and so how long did you hold on to that deal?
We held on to that deal for a little bit over 24 months.
Oh, wow. And then you sold it?
Yeah. Yeah,
okay.
We sold it.
And how'd y'all make out? If it was $1 million, do you get 100% return, 20%, 30%?
We almost doubled. We sold it for double what we got it for.
So if you bought it for $1 million, you sold it for $1 million, everybody went home. And so you got your 15%. And is that when you said, deuces, I'm out?
No. So we looked at it like this. So, again, if it was about $1 million, we sold it for $2 million. You know,
okay.
And so we made, so at the end of the day, you know, the profits would have been $1 million. And again, these are, if it was $1 million, it was less than that, but we're going to use $1 million for each.
Yeah, just an example.
But then you got to remember, too, that's just looking at kind of the big event. You also have to look at, too, the return of the cash flow from the rent. So the return was actually more than that because every month we were cash flowing. So,
cash flow anywhere from 6 to 8%. So they were getting some cash flow, some income off of their investments.
Right.
So if they put in $100,000, they're getting, you know, I don't know, 8% on that or whatever the case may be. And then they sold it. So for 2 years they got some income coming off the property, and of course depreciation and all the other stuff. So it's a tax thing as well.
All that good stuff.
And then, all that good stuff, and then they sell. And then have a, I guess, a long-term capital gain at that point, right?
Yeah,
I guess that's right.
And you're correct. And our return, just based off the cash flow, the return was close to 20%. It's like 18% cash on cash return.
Wow. Okay.
For 2 years, and then and that's not including the sale.
So look at
maybe like 240-250% total return.
Wow. Yeah. And see, and when you do deals like that, it makes it easier for you to do other deals, right? Because you can show them what you've
Correct.
Done. Yeah. You say, hey, here's my portfolio. I did this. Hey, I can do it for you guys. And everybody probably throwing money at you at this point. So fast forward. So you left that company. How long did you stay with that company after that deal closed? How long did you stay?
I was still there for like about 2 years.
Okay.
I was still there for about 2 years, yeah.
So with that kind of mentor, so to speak, what got you out the door? What made you say, hey, it's time for me to leave and do my own thing? What made you do that?
Actually, I could talk about it a little bit. I can't go into too much detail because litigation stuff. But I was in a car accident while I was working. So, again, I was a regional, so I was going from one property to another. I got into a car accident. During that process, you know, we had some lawsuits and all that kind of stuff. And we kind of decided mutually that the best thing was to part ways, which we did. For me, it was a blessing to be alive because the accident was very bad.
Wow.
And then secondly, it was another blessing because it kind of forced my hand a little bit, I would say, where I had to stand on my two a little bit more, so I didn't really have that excuse of I got work or, you know, I don't have time. I had the time to really start making a big difference in my life, and that's really where it started, because I was out. I was actually not able to work for over a year due to the accident.
Wow.
So,
sorry to hear that.
Yeah, like I said, I was blessed. A lot of people that get into some of the accidents don't make it.
So all this was in St. Louis, and then that prompted you to move back down to Houston?
Actually, after that, I actually went back to work in St. Louis. It was more of on a consulting basis. And that's when I kind of was like, no, you know, I know a lot. Like, I can really use my expertise and my experience to kind of, I can really leverage that to get more of my time back while I, you know, while I do make these moves and grow my portfolio. So I started doing that, you know. And then we had an opportunity to move down to Houston, and we were kind of eyeballing Houston for a while. So my brother has lived down here for over 10 years at this point, and one of my wife's close cousins had lived down here for a while, and we had visited, and we really liked it. And we just kind of figured, we kind of looked like, you know, this is kind of the time. You know, and our oldest was going from elementary school to junior high, but she was switching schools anyway. You know, we looked like, you know, we're going to do it. This is kind of the time. You know, down here in Houston, there's so much more opportunity. So so we made the jump. It was, and I'm not going to lie, man, it was scary. I had been in St. Louis my whole life. The only time I wasn't in St. Louis is when I was in college. So, I mean, it was, for me, it was terrifying, you know. But, you know, getting outside of your comfort zone is the only way you really reach those goals, and the only way you're ever going to strive, you know, whatever you strive for, to get there, you have to get out of your comfort zone. So I kind of constantly reminded myself of that daily. And, man, we went for it, and probably the best, not probably, definitely the best decision I think I've ever made for my family.
So how did you you know, start investing in real estate on your own? Did you have this cash from some of the deals, or how did you get the money to go right into apartment build, you know, investing? Because that's for, even though it ain't big time, but it definitely is larger than single
right.
family homes. So where did you get the funding to do that?
Yeah.
Or how did you get the funding to do that?
The same way I was taught to by my old boss. I found partners. I mean, I partnered with people.
Okay.
There's a lot of people that I was doing wholesaling down here in Houston, and I had a, you know, people would ask about, you know, I'm gonna do this, and then I'm, you know, I'm doing these flips, and then I'm buying whole houses, and then I'm my own apartment. And I always tell people, like, a lot of people think like that's a natural progression of investing,
mm-hmm.
and in reality, it doesn't necessarily have to be. You know what I mean? Like, I know people that went straight to apartments. You know what I mean? And so I told, you know, that's kind of what my pitch to people is, like, you know, I do have, you know, I have the experience to that. You know, I used to do that. You know, I did a deal back home, and I kind of broke it down for them. I let them know I'm looking for those type of deals down here, but, you know, I just need partners to get it done. After telling and talk to enough people, the same way when you're a wholesaler or a flipper, you tell enough people your story and your goals, you'll find people who are like-minded, right? And they'll be like, hey, you know, I do have some money. I would be interested in doing something like that. Can you give me more details and let me know how it works?
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I've done it. That's, again, personally, that's how I've done it. I think if the accident never would have happened, I would have used those funds and went at it by myself.
Got it.
You know, the funds
okay.
that we got from when we sold it, I would have used that to go at it by myself. But being out as long as I was out, we sold that property in time because a lot of that is what kept me and my family afloat when I didn't have, you know, any income after the accident, or I didn't
gotcha.
Have a lot of income after the accident. So,
did you delineate what your biggest obstacle was? I don't know. I heard about this big deal. I got so engrossed in that. Was your
yeah,
biggest
no,
obstacle?
It's okay.
What did we come to conclude that your biggest obstacle was?
I would say my biggest, it was two.
Okay.
Obviously, I think it was fun, which it is for
okay.
a lot of people, is
mm-hmm.
money. But bigger than that, I believe, was fear.
Fear, okay.
No doubt. No doubt. I mean, it was a fear. And having to overcome that, thinking and telling yourself, man, this probably ain't going to work. This probably, you know, and believing, like, hey, some fear is natural, right? Like, that's just how we're made, like. But you can't let ourselves get engrossed in it, you know. And then some people I meet have analysis paralysis, and what if this, and what if that, and what if this, and like, what if you don't do this deal and somebody else does, and they've made a better future for themselves. That's the question I pose to people. Like, we can say what if about everything, but that's really just our fear making an excuse for us not to do something. You know, if we know that it's a good deal, if we look at it and we analyze it, maybe we go to somebody we trust and they analyze it, and you come to the same conclusion, then you do it. You know what I mean?
And that's fear. Yeah, fear is always a big thing, and that's why when we started talking, I was sharing how I asked people, what's your end game? And an end game, you know, meaning if you're working for somebody else, helping them build their empire, whether it's a small company or big corporation, I said, well, how are you going to get out of this thing alive? What is your strategy? And most people really don't have one, okay? Somehow they think magically they're going to get this influx of money. That's why the lottery is so popular. That's, for some people, that's their end game. I'm going to hit the lottery. You know, well, good luck with that. You know, so, you know, and then when you get up in age in your 50s and stuff, you start saying, oh, I can't take too many risks. But, you know, when you hear the stories about entrepreneurs, you hear time and time and again, you hear how they failed. Okay? Mm-hmm. But they did not inculcate that. They did not, you know, take that in as a sign of their weakness or their intelligence. It's just that, hey, things happen, but they keep trying, and eventually they learn lessons from their failures, and then they move on and do well. So, you know, and a lot of people just don't want to fail. But then everybody's not cut out for this business. You know, everybody's not cut out to be an entrepreneur, because if we had all entrepreneurs, who we have to work for us, right? So
no, that's true. No, that's 100% true. I agree. I agree with that, because people say that all the time, like, well, such and such, this person can do it. This person can do it. Like, if everybody is doing it, I mean, this is just how capitalism works. If everybody's doing it, then it does not work. I'd say the most important thing I would say for anybody who is an entrepreneur is, I always looked at my team, like when I worked in corporate America, to me, my team was the blood of the organization, right? And the best way for your body to work is that your blood is moving smoothly, your blood is working properly, right? So we know, like, if our arteries get clogged, our blood's not working efficiently, right? It's hurting our heart. So if you keep putting out more things for them to do, or more overhead, or more, this is the next check, I want this report, I want this report, I want this report, you're basically clogging the arteries of your company. You know, find out what works, ask them what works, make sure you're doing things efficiently, and make sure they're happy and you treat them right, because then the rest of the body, which is your company, is going to be healthy and it's going to run. So we all don't have that spirit to be entrepreneurs, but us that do, we have to make sure that we are taking care of those people who are essentially allowing us to make our dreams come true, because without them, it don't happen.
And that is so true.
You know,
that is so true.
And we just have to make sure that we're treating our employees good, that we know them, and that we are constantly growing. I mean, I know a lot of successful business owners and entrepreneurs that are poor leaders. And, you know, if you want to take that role as a leader and as an owner of a company, you have to make sure that you're building your leadership skills and you're leading properly and you're doing the right things for my people.
And I think people
are attached
or latch on to a vision. In other words, you know, if you're a visionary of what you want to do. Now, I'm not saying you have to be a visionary like you want to make the next iPhone. I'm not talking about that so much. That could be it too. But you have a vision of where you want to go and say, you know, like in your case, you're trying to build a legacy for your children. And so you're going to make this thing as big as it can so that it can support you and your family and whatever the loved ones that you want to bring into the business. And people can either get with that, be part of that, and see what role they're going to play in that part, or they're not going to be attracted to that, you know, because, you know, either you're going to be, and I say this in closing, I say one of the things I tell people is that during this pandemic, if you don't come out of this pandemic with a new skill, some more knowledge, or a side hustle, then you don't lack time, you lack discipline. And that's something you
gotta
work on.
I agree.
You see what I'm saying? Because you always say,
I'm
gonna do this, I'm gonna do this, I'm gonna do that, I'm gonna do that. I don't have enough time, I work. Well, now you're sheltered at home, so, you know, or you lost your job, so what are you going to do about that? And it looks like with this pandemic, it's going to change the way we operate. I mean, I just think that even mm-hmm. if, even and when, because they will find a vaccine for it, it might be 6 months, a year right. out, but it has permanently, to some extent, changed the business that a lot of people are in. Businesses that said before that, oh, no, you can't work at home. Guess what? Yes, you can, right? You know, teaching.
And they're getting and they're getting more production.
They're getting more production. Right?
People,
exactly,
people are more productive.
Because now, I mean, you're not punching the clock. It's about, okay, what did you do today? Well, what did you do this week?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're at home. I'm not there looking over your shoulder, but guess what? I want to know what your output is because that's all I'm measuring.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be a good thing and a bad thing depending on the person because some people can't operate like that. Well, Angelo, thank
right.
you so much. You provided a whole lot of information for folks for them to go back and try to look at doing. You got a great niche that you're doing, not that it's unique in real estate because that's one of the areas that folks
right.
are concentrated in real estate, but you got a wealth of knowledge
mm-hmm.
And that is once again, that's just very, very, very you know, transferable to what you're doing because you kind of got mentored by somebody and now you're doing your own thing and I applaud you for that, you know, because I'm trying
Thank
to
you.
Change the narrative about, you know, what black folks are doing out here. I mean, there's black
mm-hmm.
folks doing some stuff out here, but they don't get written up in the paper because they ain't shooting, killing, or doing anything to anybody. They out here trying to make it
right.
happen. And it encourages me.
You're doing
me
a lot of positive things.
Oh, yeah. You know, the group that we're in, you know, that where I met you. I mean, just a lot of folks
mm-hmm.
in there doing some great things. And no one, you will never see us written up in the paper anywhere. Why? Because that doesn't sell papers, man. You know, my background
right.
is my undergrad is in radio, TV, film, journalism, and they're going to put out there what sells, and that means crime, any type of conflict is going to get people to read the paper or turn on the TV and watch. So I applaud you for what you're doing, Angelo. Let's keep in touch because who knows? Maybe I might decide to get into apartment. But now that you mentioned the syndication part, because in another life, I spent 10 years as a bank VP of investments. And
wow.
I had a team of financial planners. And we sold limited partnerships, not just on real estate. I'm talking back in the 80s, okay? We sold limited partnerships at $5,000 a clip, right, with the same kind of features. Also, people don't understand,
mm-hmm.
and I'm sure they do this now, you know, privately, we sold limited partnerships on movies. So a studio would come out and say, I want to raise $100
wow.
million. Dollars. Yes, and they probably still do it. I just haven't been in the game on that side for 20,
mm-hmm.
20, 30 years, but I'm assuming that they still go out there and raise money because, you know, these movies and real estate is big, and they're buying apartment complexes, storage units, all that kind of stuff. You know, so I applaud
right.
you, Angelo, for doing what you're doing. Let's keep in touch, and thank you so much for being on Your Personal Finance. Much success to you, man.
All right, thank you. I appreciate
all
you
right.
having me on. Do you mind if I throw out my social media information?
No, yeah, oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, anybody listening, you can follow me on Twitter, and you can follow me on Instagram. It is @TheMultifamilyMan.
And if you'll
yes,
text
both.
That information, and if you'll text that to me, then I'll also put it in. Because I'm gonna send you a link to this, so you can share this broadcast on your social media. So that's your Instagram. What's the other? Want to share your other social media?
Yeah, that's for Twitter and Instagram.
Oh, sorry, Twitter and Instagram. Okay, all right, got it. You have Facebook? No.
Not for that part of it. I don't.
Okay. All right. Awesome. All right. Thank you so much,
Facebook's
Angelo.
Real weird with pages.
Yeah, I found out the hard way that Facebook doesn't like you posting anything that takes people off of their site. And I can understand why
exactly.
that is, because they want you to keep the eyeballs on Facebook, just like a TV station or radio station wants you to stay tuned in to their station. They're not going to share stuff so you could go
mm-hmm.
somewhere else, you know, even though they got billions and billions of subscribers, but they don't want to be in the business of that. I learned that the hard way, you know, that when I post stuff, you know,
mm-hmm.
that has a link outside, it doesn't get any views. You got to do something different with that. So
right.
so I'm working on Instagram. I don't think it's like that, though, I think. Facebook definitely doesn't let you go outside, you know, their platform to look at anything that is not on Facebook. So that's why now you see Facebook is coming up with news and all that kind of stuff. You know why? Because they don't like the news organizations that have Facebook pages, you know, getting people to go off the site, going to their, you know, website, whether it's a TV, radio, or print. So Anyway. All right, Angelo. Well, take care, man. All right. So, man, good brother to talk to, man. We went a lot longer than I anticipated, but, you know, I have folks on that have knowledge that I don't have, and that's a lot. I mean, my knowledge is very small in terms of, you know, doing certain things. But when I see a brother doing stuff in commercial real estate, which is something I aspire to, that it's really a great thing. One of the things that I wanted to share, he talked about real estate education. I'm a part of two organizations that is helping me with my end game, which is to retire in 3 years with $150,000 to $200,000 in income. The first one is real estate. You know, I'm a part of an organization where I'm buying property anywhere from $25,000 to $35,000, renting them out for $600 to $700 a month apiece, getting cash flow of about 20%. Okay, if you want to be part of that, I'll give you my contact information in just a minute. Second part is that going along with that, I wanted to find a way that I can help people with their financial lives. That's what this show is all about. And also have an opportunity to fund my real estate deals. So one of the companies that I'm a part of, we provide financial services. Financial planning is part of it. The other part is credit repair and restoration. And it's a great organization because a lot of people, 43 million to be exact, have credit scores of under 600. And if you have a credit score under 600, there's not a whole lot you can do with that. I'm sure if that's your case, you know that's the case. And so these two organizations are helping me with my financial end game, and it could help you with yours too. It's just so you have the courage to strike out on it, because a lot of people don't have an end game, they don't think about it, or they stay up nights worrying about it. But you got to do something. You've got to do something, because doing nothing is the same as doing something. You know, because you're doing something, because not you, and do nothing. That's what it is. So if you're interested, let me give you my contact information. You can reach me via email at charlesross@outlook.com, or quicker would be through phone, 404-272-4633. And just if you're interested in the credit part, you know, the financial planning credit part, then just text credit. If you're interested in the real estate stuff, just text RE for real estate, okay? Thank you so much for being a part of our show. And once again, much success to you as you embark on your end game.